Hello, I'm David McGowan, and welcome to Untold Stories. This episode was recorded live on stage at the Florida Theater in downtown Jacksonville on February 12, 2022. And this audio series is a production of WJCT Public Media and the Florida Theater. Untold Stories at the Florida Theater is made possible in part by generous support from the Wolfbrook family.
Woo! Hi! How are you doing? Good? Wow, we have a good audience. I am thrilled. Okay, so tonight's theme is Out of the Swamp. And it's sort of amazing when you just ask people, can you think of a story that has anything to do with Out of the Swamp? And they start thinking. And I said that to a lot of people months ago, and people started coming forward and saying, I think I have something. And so tonight, you are going to hear six storytellers. Their stories really demonstrate strength, resilience, and rebirth. And it's been such an honor for me to coach them through these tales, digging deeper, so that we are presenting to you a very curated story and reflection. We're going to kick the night off with a musical act. And we have tonight Brent Bird, and he is a Northeast Florida resident. His music, well, it's going to speak for itself, but he's a little bit Southern rock and blues and kind of a throwback to 60s and 70s music, which, of course, I'm all about. He's been the opening act for many people, and I'm thrilled to have him tonight. This is the first. He's going to introduce the evening, but he'll be coming back throughout, okay? Big, big hand for Brent Burt.
How's everybody doing tonight? Good, good, good. Well, I am Brent Bird, the one and only. I mean, there might be another one out there somewhere, but I'm this one.
Down to the sea. No, we know now, yeah, it's always sea. And what will be will always be. Say, walk with me until you're the same. But only to find out nothing here is what it seems. You know that you've got to stay true to what you believe in. Yeah, that's right, yeah. But it feels like heaven is coming down to me. With lightning crashing down to the sea. And oh, it's always sea. And what will be will always be. But it feels like heaven is coming down to me. With lightning crashing down to the sea. It's always sea. And what will be will always be.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brett Bird. Johnny Moskalevich is a Chicago native. He's a poet and a creator of the award-winning Happy Tapir zine series. His publishing house, Happy Tapir Press, distributes the work of other Northeast Florida writers. He's very committed to getting people's voices out there and helps you do it. And he's a regular at MySpace, Babs Lab. He always comes to the Story Slams. In fact, he wins a lot, and he's going to be in our Grand Slam in March. So please, please, please welcome Johnny Moskalevich. Woo!
I am walking on a narrow wooden dock above the dark, dark swamp water. Water so dark that even light can't escape it. And though I can't see underneath the surface, I know that water is filled with creatures lurking there, watching me, following me. And as I keep walking, I see the occasional flick of a tail or the ripple from a scaly back. And when two eyes pop above the surface and look at me, I notice and I learn that the water is filled with alligators watching me, following me. And as I continue to walk, I see that the dock is slanted just a little bit, and it's getting closer and closer to that dark water. And I look all the way up, and right where the dock meets the water, I watch in horror as a giant bull alligator pulls itself up onto the wooden planks. So I step back and I turn just in time to see behind me another gator crawling up onto the dock behind me and turning and walking towards me. And because of the weight of the gators, the dock starts to sink in the water, and all the gators on the left of me and on the right of me start rising to the top of the water and come charging at me with their mouths open. And then I wake up. I've had the alligator nightmare for as long as I can remember. Somewhere decades ago, my psyche decided to make the alligator the avatar of everything that is terrifying and horrifying to me. And it's not too out of the ordinary. I mean, they are scary beasts, but here's the thing. Like she said, I'm up in Chicago. The closest swamps and the closest gators are half a continent away. And besides, I'm actually dealing with my own real life nightmare. See, my marriage of 7 years is failing. As marriages often do, we're just starting to grow apart. We're not at the precipice yet, but we're going to get there. But I'm in Chicago, and I'm fighting for it, and I've got the strength of the city, and I've got the support of my family and my friends and my life's blood in that city. But then she tells me that we're moving to Florida, the land of the swamps and the gators, and the red flags went up. And we got in a house right at the end of Julianton Creek, where the water is dark and still and swampy. And that very first night when I went to the house and I looked out the back window and I saw the lawn, and then beyond that, some Florida scrub, and beyond that, the black swamp water, and a narrow wooden dock out over that water. And in the moonlight, I watched a real-life gator cruise along right underneath that dock, and I knew that I was now living in my nightmare. But we decided to make the best of it, and we jumped into our Florida life. I started working at Barnes & Noble, the bookstore on San Jose, and she started law school, and we tried to make this work. We tried to live a normal life, but I always felt those nightmares lurking beneath that dark water. And no matter how much we tried, I needed to do something because our marriage was on the rocks. Our marriage was on the rocks. And suddenly, I got an idea. You see, I am a Midwestern boy. I was raised up in the land of the Great Lakes, these giant, giant bodies of water gouged out by the glaciers, crystal clear streams, the area where the Mississippi River runs clear before it becomes the Big Muddy. I grew up in a place where most natural bodies of water were crystal clear, and you could see all the way to the very bottom. And here's the thing, when you can see all the way to the very bottom, there's nothing that can lurk in that water. There's nothing that could sneak up on you. So when I looked out at that black water, I knew what I had to do. I knew I had to be able to see the bottom. So, got in my car, and I drove to Lowe's, and I picked out a couple bags of the whitest gravel I could find. And I loaded them into the car, and I drove back home, and I schlepped those bags out to the dock, and I split that first bag open, and I dumped it into the water, and it disappeared into the blackness. So I did it with the next one, and the next one, and each time they kind of disappeared, but I still had a feeling, so I went back to Lowe's and loaded up again. That day, I must have gone back 8, 9 times, and each time, the rock disappeared into the water. But the very last bag, on that very last trip, when I poured it in, I could just barely see through the water that white rock. And at that moment, I knew this might work. And so that became a little bit of my life. I go to Lowe's, I load up on gravel, I bring it back home and I dump it into the water. I do that whenever I had some free time. After a week or so at that Lowe's, I kind of extinguished their supply and I moved across the street to the Home Depot. Now still I was living my life. I'd be at work, should have been thinking about books, but I was thinking about rocks. Or I was at the gym and I'm lifting weights and I'm thinking, wait, rocks are heavy, that works, and I'd go get some more rocks. And I kept doing that over and over and over, trying to give a base to this muddy swamp water, trying to be able to see underneath the water to push away my nightmares and my fears. And I was doing it all on my own. Yes, a marriage is two people and two people should work on this, but I was the man and I was going to deal with these nightmares and I was going to do it myself. And sometimes when I was schlepping rocks, I'd look back at the house and my wife would be in the window and I'd wave to her and sometimes she'd wave back and sometimes she wouldn't. And still, I schlepped rocks. And now you think, this is a lot of work for one person. Why don't, instead of doing this over and over and over and over with my car, why don't I just rent an entire dump truck of gravel and have them bring it there and pour it right in? And I went to my wife and I said, I got this great idea about getting a whole dump truck of gravel. And my wife, remember, who's in law school, said, well, here's the thing. What you're doing is probably against enough zoning laws and environmental regulations to get you thrown into jail for quite some time. And so I didn't do the dump truck. Plus, it would have cost a lot of money, and I was running out of money. In fact, I was getting so low on funds that when I extinguished and exhausted all the Lowe's and Home Depots in my area, I started going to the off-brand stores for some off-brand gravel. And yes, it might have not have been as fine and it might have not been as white, but it started to be all that I could afford. And I'm going out, I'm coming back, I'm going out, I'm coming back. And on the last trip I went out with my very last dollar to get some gravel, I was at a stoplight and I looked over. And here was a construction site where a building had just been knocked down. And there was this huge pile of rock, white rock, free rock. And it must have been a Sunday because there were no construction workers around. So I pulled my car up and I started taking these huge chunks of white concrete and filling my car with them. And I schlepped them back to the house and dragged them out to the dock and started dropping them in the water. And I kept doing that. So now here was my mission. I'd drive around looking for construction sites. I'd look around. I'd see a broken sidewalk. I'd go take that rock. I'd see a curb that a truck had run over and busted up. And I'd go take that rock. Back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, trying to build a bottom to my swamp. And I was doing a good job, and I was getting away with it, but I came really close one time to getting caught, because I'm out there on the dock, and all of a sudden, around the corner, in his little forest ranger boat, comes the local forest ranger. And he sees me standing there on a dock, and he sees me with a big rock in my hand, and he goes, what you doing? And I said, nothing. And he said, okay then, have a good day. And he kept going. But I knew I was busted, so I had to start working at night. So So my days were filled with getting rocks, and my nights were filled with dumping it in the water. Getting the rocks here, dumping it in the water here. Sometimes I'd work by the light that came from the windows in the house. But when it got late and my wife turned off the lights and went to bed, I'd work by the light of the moon. Day in, day out, just getting rocks and dumping rocks, getting rocks and dumping rocks. And my arms were becoming stronger, and my back was becoming bent, and my shoulders were becoming stooped. But I had to do this. I had to put a base on that swamp. I had to fend away my nightmares. I had to make this work. And one day, I woke up outside. I was at the point right where the dock meets the ground, the shore. I must have fallen asleep from exhaustion the night before, and the sun woke me up. And I watched the sun rays drop down that morning, and I saw them hit the swamp water and get sucked in like a black hole. And as the sun rose, the rays moved across the water, still disappearing into the swamp. And then they hit the end of the dock. And all of a sudden, a bright reflection came from the water. The sun was shining through the water onto my rocks. I had done it. I had created a white base around the entire dock. I had created a haven where no gators could come sneak up on me, where those nightmares were pushed away, where those nightmares could not get me. I had done it. I had finally done it. And I ran into the house to tell my wife that we had done it. And she was gone. I was so obsessed with dealing with this nightmare and these fears that I totally ignored the actual one on hand. And she had left. And so now I was alone. But I still had my dock, and I still had my swamp floor that I could see to the bottom of, and I still had my protection against the alligators. But then I experienced my first hurricane season. And when the rains came and the water started to rise and got higher and higher up to that dock, and then the first storm surge came, dragging with it tons and tons of mud and silt and the detritus from the bottoms of the swamps and the creeks and the rivers, and it swept down Julington Creek and it covered up all my work, disappearing those rocks underneath feet of mud and dirt. And the water kept rising, and the dock disappeared, and the water rose over the scrub, and the water rose over the lawn, and the water rose all the way to the back of my house, and the gators came with it too. And I looked down out the back window, and here are gators walking and swimming across my what had been a newly mowed lawn. And at that moment, I realized they're always gonna be here. The nightmares, the fears, yeah, you can push them away for a little while, but they're always going to come back, and you just got to learn to live with them. And I might have been alone now in Florida, but that didn't mean that I had to give in to the fears. And I met some people, and I met these friends, and I met a lot of you out there. And I got active in the community, and I started my publishing company, and I started doing open mics, and I ended up on the stage of the Florida Theater. And every day, I think about how I conquered those fears. And every day, I remind myself how I rose out of that swamp water and I rose above the alligators of my nightmares. And if I ever forget that, I just take a look at these sweet-ass alligator shoes I got. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Good job. I love those alligator shoes. Okay, I want some. That literally is out of the swamp, right? Okay. I'm wondering if, like, a good present for Johnny is to give him a bag of white rocks. Okay, so next up, this is someone I barely know. I met, she showed up one night at a story slam, and actually her name got called first, and she went on the stage, and I heard a story of hers, and she just stuck with me. And so when I was looking for storytellers, I was thinking, I think Naga might have an interesting story. So it's Naga Wasserman, and she is a swing dancer, an avid swing dancer. You could find her at the Volstead. She teaches the Lindsay Hop. I don't know how many of you remember that. The interesting thing about her is she is also a black belt. She's a black belt in martial arts. Swing dancer, and I mean, you don't know which one's gonna come at you, all right? She is prepared, all right? If you can't dance with her, you just don't piss her off, is what I'm saying. Okay, so she was born and raised in Florida. She is a UNF alum, and please, please welcome Naga Wasserman.
It was in the small town of Sebastian, Florida, that I was born and raised on an ashram, if you needed something else about me. And an ashram is basically a spiritual community, but at this ashram, there were no strangers, only family. So the kids were my brothers, sisters, cousins, the adults were my aunts and uncles, and the elderly were my grandparents. Everyone from all walks of life were welcome. Growing up there, I could just literally run wild and free. Literally, you just, I don't know where your mom is, but there she goes. Another part of my upbringing was the phrase, kindness is our religion, and I was steeped in that notion. We're also brought up on acts of service to others, and my mom applied this without bounds. I remember her having so many things that she had to do and getting things dropped in her lap. Can you cover my class? Can you walk the dogs? Can you polish the statues? And I could see the stress in the lines of her face, but you couldn't hear it through the phone that she was talking through as she said yes to everything. Another thing about me as a kid, I was always aware of how I felt, how I made others feel, and how they made me feel. And I would be in like a group of people, and yet somehow like partitioned off by way of like body positioning, whether it was intentional or not, but I understood how I felt and why certain things made me feel that way, and I never wanted to make anybody feel left out. So whenever I was with a group of people, I was vigilant. I kept an eye out for those people, and I became a beacon of the awkward and left out, and I made sure that they were included. So I took this forward with me. When I was 4 years old, I started dancing ballet. I was the cutest little ballerina. I loved dancing, I loved performing on stage, it was so much fun. And then when I was 10, I got into swing dancing and Lindy Hop because my brother started going with his friends. His friends became like my brothers. And we danced so many Saturday nights away at the studio and then refueled like our lives depended it at Denny's. And I did this for years. Now, it was the summer before my senior year of high school that I met Josh. Josh was a music man, and I was the tiny dancer. And we fell in love very quickly. Now, over the course of my senior year, I decided that I was gonna move to Jacksonville and go to UNF. So I go to UNF, and it's at this point when I decide to move that Josh makes known that he's not comfortable with me having guy friends. And he also doesn't want me to go dancing because, gasp, physical contact with another guy. So, you know, I did what I had to do, and I made as many girlfriends as I could, and I didn't go dancing. So this goes on for a couple of years, and I made some amazing girlfriends. They're still my rocks to this day. Some of them are here tonight. Now, we had our home base, which was like any one of our houses at any given point where we could just show up, drink whiskey, write 6-page papers at midnight that were due the next day for class, or just come unannounced and hang out. And one year, my friends threw this Halloween party. So I'm out front in the yard, hanging out with a bunch of people. Josh is inside. He had come up to visit. And I'm in this group of people, and there's two guys there that had said they go to UNF. How exciting, right? We started talking about UNF life and the things that we like to do on campus, our classes. And at some point, I realized that everyone else in that circle had kind of peeled off, and it was just the three of us. And I also suddenly became aware of how close they were to me. Now, this was a pretty common thing that happened to me, where I would suddenly realize that the tone had shifted. And I became aware of that discomfort, and I stepped back, relief, but it didn't last long. They stepped closer. And so I stepped back, and they came closer. I stepped back, and they came closer until I was backed up against this pillar by the stairs. And the only way for me to get further away from them was to sit on the pillar, and I did. And they came closer still. They were oblivious. Now, I kept the conversation going as normal because, God forbid, I should make them feel uncomfortable. I don't want people to feel uncomfortable because of me. So you would never have known looking at me. But it was in this moment where I could not go anywhere that the panic started to set in because I knew what came next. And it was in that moment of panic that Josh came out and he saw this and he put his arm around me and I felt so relieved and ashamed in equal magnitudes. You see, this was not the first time anything like this had happened. It was far from the worst, but it was the first time that he had been there for it. And I hated that. For the rest of the night and days to come, my blood boiled with anger. I decided that I had to do something about this. It had to stop. Was I asking for it to happen? I just didn't understand. I needed to understand. So I went to a counselor. Well, the counselor I got was my classmate. So I walked into this room, beige walls, no windows, brown furniture, this slender woman who was in my mental health class, and a desk between us. And I sat down, and I tried to make words come out, but all that came out was just waterworks and tears. And eventually, I did get words out, and I asked her, after pouring forth my deepest, darkest secrets that had never seen the light of day until this moment, I asked her, how do I make this go away? What do I do? How do I make it stop? It has to. I'm afraid to tell Josh. What if he doesn't understand? And this is where I started to collect my little bits of don'ts. Don't have guy friends. Don't go dancing. In addition to that, I got don't smile. Don't laugh. Don't touch people too much. Don't be too friendly. Don't drink too much, that makes you even more friendly. Don't wear that, they might get the wrong idea. And yeah, you probably shouldn't tell Josh because you're right, he might not understand. So I took my little basket of don'ts that was really, really heavy, and I tried to go through the world with that. And it worked, but it wasn't me. It felt like having a bodyguard, but not one that was meant to keep others out. It felt more like it was meant to keep me in. But it was all I had. So I went through with that for years. Now, it would be a couple more years before Josh and I ended up splitting shortly after I graduated college. And the first thing I did, I called my friend Blake and I asked him, when are you going dancing next? I'm coming with you. And I did. I drove all the way to Tampa with him. We went dancing. And for the first time in years, I came alive. As the jazz music that filled that dance hall filled my soul, I came alive. And it was one of the most memorable nights of my life. I came back to Jacksonville, and the first place I went dancing was the Volstead right over on East Adams Street. And shortly after that, I started teaching the lessons there. Before I knew it, swing dancing was my identity. and I built a safe haven there. My swing dancers are my safe haven. I can run wild and free, and so can they. And they know that wherever we are together, we're a family. We even have a flag that we take when we travel to other swing dance scenes so that people know here is home, here is safety. Now, when I'm not around my swing dancers, I am watchful. It's like stepping out of this fantasy world of safety, this cocoon. But I have learned that my comfort matters, my comfort is valuable, I am valuable, and I've learned to use my voice. I've turned those don'ts into do's. Don't smile too much. I smile unapologetically, and if you're the one that makes me uncomfortable, I have no obligation towards your comfort. You will know. So I've redefined what kindness is to me. I'm a work in progress, but I've learned that kindness is not always comfortable, and that's okay. I've learned that kindness without boundaries is not kindness, it's conditioning. And kindness is also kindness to yourself sometimes. So, thank you.
I am thinking, okay, about our next storyteller. And, well, she's a multifaceted artist, truly. She's an actress. She's a playwright. She's a filmmaker. She's an educator. She's just sort of amazing person who has worked really hard to create this life. That's incredible. She'll tell you about it, but I recently saw a film that she produced, and the soundtrack of the film was from her sixth studio album. The film, Kwangoza, was the winner of the Detroit Black Film Festival. I mean, that's amazing. And you've got to look it up. It's on all the streaming platforms. I was blown away the night that I saw it. And by the way, she's the executive director of the Performers Academy, right? A nonprofit arts education, and they do amazing work, and she heads that up. So here is my dear friend, Ebony Payne.
Whenever I consider my childhood or my time in college, it seems absolutely wild to me that I would end up here on the Florida theater stage. I mean, how does an impoverished, dark-skinned little black girl from Duval County's 103rd Street overcome several suicide attempts and grow up to become so iconic that she has not one but two murals of her likeness in her conservative hometown of Andrew Jacksonville, Florida. It's really quite simple. I never learned to drown. When I was working at Wells Fargo, I met a woman named Sharita Santa Cruz, and she specialized in project management. I was running my boyfriend's nonprofit at the time because he had gotten invited on an 8-month tour, And he left, and I had the teenagers, 20 of them, with no curriculum and an international poetry competition just 3 months away. So I hired Sharita to help me put the field trip together. And our first project meeting was at my house. So we're sitting in the middle of my floor, surrounded by paperwork. And my boyfriend's calling me, asking me if I've checked on his mom and if I walked the dog and had I remembered to send this email. And Sharita stops and looks at me, puts her hand on my shoulder and says, "Ebony, what are you doing?" The truth of the matter was I was in a dead-end relationship. I was running somebody else's business while neglecting my own and my mental, emotional, and artistic health. I was stressed, depressed, and suicidal. But I didn't say any of that. I smiled and said, "Helping people makes me happy. He's going to be a big star, you know." She looked at me and said, "No, baby. You got it all wrong. You're the star." And that was a transformational moment for me. When I was a little girl, I used to wish on shooting stars for the life that I live today. I wanted nothing more than to grow up and become one of the greatest entertainers of all time. Ever since I was old enough to look over the bathroom sink and into the mirror, I would put skirts on my head and give acceptance speeches into my hairbrush. That was before my struggle with depression, before my first suicide attempt at 10 years old, and before my sexual assaults. It was before I had sank so deep into this swamp of self-loathing that I couldn't even see myself anymore. Eventually, Sharita took me on as a client and became my brand manager. She taught me how to swim. I left that relationship, but not empty-handed. I kept those 20 teens, and I started my own nonprofit. I facilitated weekly workshops at the Maine Library Teen Center for 8 years. And during that time, those 20 teens turned into more like 200. Upon learning of my diagnosis with HIV, one of my high schoolers asked me, "Was there anything in my life I believed my illness would keep me from?" I told him it would prevent me from becoming a mother, which was extremely disappointing because I always wanted kids. And he looks at me with the cutest little puppy dog face his 16-year-old mug could muster, and says, "But you do have kids. I'm right here." And so I swam my way through my diagnosis in the company of my youth who never allowed me to drown. And I eventually met a wonderful man who they all adored. And 4 years later, we gave birth to a little human many of you know as Mahogany Rose. And all of his excitement about becoming a big brother, that same student got Mahogany the most obnoxious gift. It's a 3-foot-long, 30-pound stuffed animal, baby orca. Right? And she loves this thing, loves it. Even till this day, it's her favorite toy. It takes up the entire bottom half of her bed. It takes up the entire back seat of my car. Does that prevent her from wanting to take it everywhere? Of course not, but this is motherhood. If it makes her happy and quiet, we make it happen. And my motherhood journey has been just as wonderful as I imagined it would be, just not as collaborative as I'd hoped. Unfortunately, addiction has prevented Mahogany Rose's father from interacting with us normally, and I find myself once again in the bathroom mirror preparing acceptance speeches. But not for an award. I'm preparing myself to accept that one day she's gonna ask me about her father, and I need to know in advance what my response will be. And sure enough, when Mahogany Rose was 2 years old, she began throwing wild, violent tantrums at school, rolling around in the middle of the floor at home, snatching away from me in grocery stores and screaming at the top of her lungs, "I want daddy! Where's daddy? I want dad!" It was heartbreaking. And I wasn't prepared for all that I'd feel. So one day, after having to pick her up early from school after a tantrum, I brought her home and sat her on the couch. I gave her a snack and turned on the Discovery Channel's Oceans documentary. I went into my bedroom to cry it out. And before I could close the door, Mahogany screaming, "Mommy! Mommy, can we go to the beach?" "Not right now, Mahogany. It's not a good time, okay? Some other day." "But Mommy, we have to take baby Orca back to his family." See, what's happening right now is Morgan Freeman's voiceover and all of its infinite wisdom is in my living room, talking to my daughter about orcas and pods and how if an orca is captured or lost, that orca's family comes back to the same place it was captured or lost at every year, looking for it. But Mommy, his mommy and daddy really miss him. And so at this point, I realize it's not just about baby Orca for her. It's about family. So I call my best friend who does mine and Mahogany Rose's hair because I remember something she was saying to me about ocean water being good for our locks. And I ask her, "What was it?" And she says, "Yeah, you should dip your hair in seawater every now and then because it's good for your scalp and it stimulates growth." So I ask her if she wants to make a thing out of it and take Mahogany Rose to the beach tomorrow so we can dip her locks for the first time. She's down, so the next day I grab a 50-gallon trash bag. I stuff baby Orca into it, right? I pack him, my daughter, my best friend into my hatchback, and we drive to Neptune Beach. Get out of the car. I put the blanket down. I put baby Orca in the middle of the blanket. I look at Mahogany Rose and I say, "He's very allergic to sand." And then we go down to the water and take our dips. My best friend, she picks up Mahogany Rose, just as she does whenever she washes her hair, and leans over. They have this mantra that they say right before the water comes. "You got me, and I got you." And Mahogany Rose is submerged into the ocean for the first time. And she comes up completely discombobulated and crying and runs back to the blanket. My best friend goes running after her, and I'm left there alone to take my bits. But there's this cry still in my throat. So thick, it's choking me up. And Sharita's family's tradition, sidebar, I would eventually find out that Sharita is the great-great-granddaughter of Marie Laveau, the voodoo queen of New Orleans. And in her family tradition, it's believed that the ocean, or Mami Wata, is the collector of our tears. She transfers them into testimony. And so I step out into the deep, and I go under, and I release it. And before I have the chance to let it all go, Mahogany Rose is screaming, "Mommy, Mommy, look, it's baby Orca's family." So I pop up and I try to get the salt water out of my eyes that are now burning. And lo and behold, there are 5 dolphins. One there, one there, one there, one there, and one right there, forming a crescent moon right in front of me. And it is the most majestic thing that has ever happened to me. So here's the thing with me and dolphins. Ever since I was a little girl, I wanted to swim with dolphins. I got a chance to go to SeaWorld and swim with dolphins in the 7th grade, but my biology teacher, Mr. Souder, talked me out of it, saying that I shouldn't be finding joy in captivity, right? And so I went to Universal Studios instead, regretted it. And then in college, I bought this package when I went to the Bahamas where you get to snorkel and see the coral reef and swim with dolphins. And so, like, the coral was really beautiful and all the little fish like my toenail polish, but there were no dolphins that day. It was like they were on vacation. That is, until it was time for me to walk across the little drawbridge when you're getting back on the cruise ship. And I'm like walking across, and a whole school of dolphins swims underneath me as if to say, "Better luck next time." Now here I am. They're swimming around me in circles at Neptune Beach. And all of this is on the strength of Mahogany Rose's faith. Now, I may have allowed her to believe they were baby orcas' family, but don't judge me. She was happy and quiet for at least a week. Anyway, the tears I cried into the ocean that day were not of sorrow. They were tears of gratitude for Sharita, reminding me of my glow. For my best friend, reminding me that the source of all black girl magic is togetherness. You got me, and I got you. See, us black girls, we're all shooting stars, aiming to be reincarnated as a granted wish, and even this ambition is a long shot. The clouds, like hopelessness, done got thick and nobody cares to wish anymore. It is an extremely brave thing to dream when you're poor.
So Ebony right now is on her way to Blue Jay Listening Room. She's headlining there for the WJCT Story Night. So she's had quite a day, and it will continue this evening. And thank you, Ebony, for making this happen. Yeah.
This audio series is a production of WJCT Public Media and the Florida Theater. Untold Stories at the Florida Theater is made possible in part by generous support from the Wolfberg family. I'm David McGowan. Join us again next Sunday evening at 7 for another edition of Untold Stories.